Just because they seem normal doesn't mean they are. Welcome to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Let's get another fine human being. Brian Koberger confessed, waived appeal. He's done. But a new book and a fired up defense expert are trying to sell doubt about a closed case, and his own former defense team just went public to tear the expert apart. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, is with myself and Robin Drake to help break down who's credible, who's not, and whether any of this actually matters. Me and Robin tried to do the book over last week. And honestly, I got like 2 hours. How far did you get? I got 2 hours in before I said I'm done.
About two or three. And actually, it's the only, it's the first Audible book I actually ever returned in my life to get my credit back.
Yeah, I didn't know you could return Audible books until you told me that.
But luckily I did it, because you can only do it if you use a credit to get it. And that's what I got. I got my credit back. And first time I ever did it, I just couldn't stomach it. And it just... It was just way off.
I did too. I it was like, this is bullshit. But anyway, that's our opinion. But let's talk about what, because there is some, there's some smoke coming here out of it. And I think it's important to address it so it just doesn't, you know, continue to spread and turn into a wildfire. Brent Turvey signed a confidentiality agreement when he was hired by Koberger's defense. He's now talking to reporters and collaborated on the book and has been making claims allegedly about evidence he reviewed under that agreement. Ann Taylor's team has said that he was never released from the confidentiality agreement. Turvey says everything he shared was already public. So I'm coming to you, legal man, as a former prosecutor. Does a defense expert get to decide on his own when his confidentiality agreement no longer applies in a case that's already closed?
The short answer is no. You know, the answer is that the confidentiality agreement and the terms of that agreement would govern whether this expert could disclose information, what information can be disclosed, and under what circumstances. But there's other legal provisions that might be applicable. If the expert thought that the defense attorney committed some kind of violation of law or ethical duty in their representation. You can't have an NDA that prevents disclosure of a crime. So you probably can't have an NDA that prevents disclosure of unethical activity on behalf of a professional who's governed by an ethics board. I think he has an argument, that the expert has an argument that, one, all this is publicly available anyway, so what's the harm? What sort of harm is there from disclosing this? Two, I was simply disclosing things that I thought were unlawful under legal and ethical standards. And I think a judge might look at that and say, we can't shut a guy up because they're trying to be a whistleblower. I think that that's how the expert might frame it.
So here's my question I've been waiting to ask you, Eric, since I started trying to read this book. It was tough for me to read based on the premise, and I'm curious about whether my understanding of this is correct or not, because it's legal based, and I'm just a simple human behavior type guy. So the premise that the author used for writing the book was that it's not, because he said he agreed that Koberger was guilty, but once he saw these 59,000 documents that was given to him under shady circumstances because of the non-disclosure the guy signed and all whatevers, but he said he felt morally compelled to shed the light on these documents that didn't have their day to be flushed out in court, that there's inaccuracies that and there's with chain of custody. In other words, he's laid out all these things. But as I understand it, that motive is off. It's wrong. And here's why. And that's what I'm curious about your thought on, of whether it's right or not. It didn't get its day in court to be flushed out because Ann Taylor and her team, in conjunction obviously with Koberger, decided it's in their best interest, again, going back to our previous conversation, number one objective, preserve his life from the death penalty. And as a team, based on what they had, the raw information without being flushed out in court, said to them, they couldn't win this case, and they're deciding to make the call to plead to save his life. So his argument that these things are inaccurate here, it doesn't matter because they probably would have been if they had their day in court, but they made the decision not to give it this day in court because they saw it as unwinnable. Is that accurate?
You know, that's kind of how I see it, Robin. Look, experts disagree all the time. Prosecution and defense experts, civil plaintiff and civil defense experts disagree about demonstrable facts, about objective things, about things that are on video and stuff like that. So the fact that this expert, you know, thought there may have been some inaccuracies, some chain of custody issues, that is going to be one small piece of a defense counsel's analysis, especially in a death penalty case. And if defense, you know, concludes, hey, we could make a big rah-rah deal about this thing, but it's minor. There's all this substantial evidence against the dude anyway. And if we go the route of making a big deal about it at trial, we risk this guy getting killed. Whereas if we take a plea, it preserves the guy's life. And that risk of him being killed is so high based on the other evidence that it's not worth it. And I imagine that's how Ann Taylor analyzed it.
Thanks. And when you look at the credibility of Ann Taylor and her years and experience, and as nervous as we were here, because, innocent until proven guilty, but we're all rooting for the fact that she wasn't going to win these appeals. I mean, she was pounding that stone hard, we thought, and doing a really good job of it. And to have her second guest on that when it wasn't even had its day in court, it was just interesting. That's why I had a hard time reading his conjecture, the author's conjecture, because it was him, the guy who gave it to him, and one unnamed other agent. No experience, no reps in this area, no legal reps, and that was pure conjecture on that point. So that was why I had a hard time with it. I was just curious about your thoughts on whether that's the right thought I had. Thank you.
What's, I think, getting a lot of people about this book is the interpretation of the situation, of the evidence, and the interpretation that the book seems to make, and some the author, I believe, and the some of the experts here, in the way I've read it, in my opinion, is that the evidence, the DNA evidence specifically, the knife sheath, that the chain of custody, they're saying it was broken, and they're backing that up by saying because the sheet that was on the evidence bag itself, it was all written in the same pen by the same person, signing different names at different times, but it looks like it was all done at once. Okay, on the surface, that looks rather weird. Like, that seems somewhat questionable. And then you take 2 seconds and you ask the question of the police, and they're like, oh, well, we do it digitally. That's just supplemental. It's just kind of there. You know, it's like, it could be there. It doesn't have to be there, but we have a much better system. We scan it, and it's digital down to the second that it was scanned in. We know exactly who did it. It's much more reliable. You know, it's like somebody saying that I'd rather pay with a check because it's more secure, even though your banking information is all there, but somehow they believe it's more accurate because it's on a piece of paper. When reality, that credit card's going to be a hell of a lot more secure and safer and accurate. It's a perception thing, and the perception is inherently wrong. Everybody can come to their own conclusion, but when it's inherently wrong, and then it's backed up, and then it's published, and the other side of the equation is not present when someone's consuming the information, you have thousands of people who consume that and go, oh my God, look at this. And it's really nothing. And most people never take the time to fully inform themselves on what the reality is. They're just going to go with that because it fits the narrative that seems more comfortable to them. There's really nothing inherently illegal about that. Ethically, it's irresponsible. Morally, it's irresponsible. But beyond that, I mean, Taylor bringing up, you know, hey, you're speaking out of turn here with your NDA, and releasing a statement about it. But beyond that, just making reckless statements, I guess, is there any recourse for that for anybody who might want to take it, whether it be Ann Taylor, whether it be the families of the victims, who inevitably will be harassed more by the pro-burger morons out there on this planet that unfortunately still share our atmosphere. I'm wondering, you know, is there anything for that type of reckless reporting, in my opinion?
I don't think there is, in part, Tony, because I think the expert's going to say, hey, this was my opinion. This is, you know, I looked at this and this is how I felt. This is my belief. It's different than a statement of fact for which a defamation claim can be brought. And, you know, just think about how this would play out at trial. I think Ann Taylor was totally right to make the decision she did, because the bar to admitting the sheath is authenticity, among some other standards, which is it what it purports to be? Does it, are you saying that the sheath that was found there, and if there is some little report that says, oh, look, see, this report looks weird, doesn't it? The prosecutor is going to say, oh, well, there's a digital explanation for this. And on top of that, we've done extensive DNA testing. And on top of that, we have the vehicle evidence. We have the cell phone evidence. We have everything else. Mm-hmm. And so shut the fuck up. I think a jury is going to be like, oh, this stupid little chain of custody document that was handwritten is trivial.
Mm-hmm. It's a shut the fuck up response, right?
I mean, that's the reality of it. I mean, just saying something offensive or irresponsible is not necessarily illegal. I mean, he could write a book saying that he's convinced or that he believes Brian Koberger thought the victims were aliens and his dog was telling him to do it.
Exactly what I was thinking.
And the author maybe slightly believes that, you know, golden doodles speak to him when he goes to Petco. I mean, I'm just throwing random crazy shit out there, but you could publish that. And it's up to the other people in the world to either go, this is insane, or take it in and go, see?
Finally, someone's speaking my truth.
I guess that's the problem of the world that we live in today. The craziness used to die with craziness because there wasn't ways to continue to perpetuate it. Now we have communities for crazy, and the communities for crazy perpetuate crazy and then spread it to other people who are just unhinged enough to believe it. And then it just spreads further, and it ends up spreading back to the actual living victims here in a case like that. I think that's why it's so upsetting to so many, because it ends up re-victimizing people who've already gone through hell.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think that that's part of the discomfort and frustration with a free speech society. And I think that we just have to tolerate a good amount of bullshit, because clamping down on it would result in a potential chilling effect on free speech. You know, people are allowed to say stuff, even if it's offensive, even if it's insulting, even if it's not true in some circumstances. So, yeah, I think it's just kind of a function of our setup.
And besides, there's nothing more in life I love than debunking nutters, man. I love debunking conspiracy theorists.
Yeah, I agree. I don't even know what to make of this. It feels like this, in my opinion, here's my opinion. It feels like, I don't know if I want to call it a cash grab or what, but
looks that way.
The fact that they couldn't even pronounce the Gonzalez name correctly in the audiobook, I think tells you all you need to know about how legit the damn book is.
You know, I mean, we hit this the other day too, Tony. It is so, because you've narrated your own books. I've narrated all my books. And for this to be with a mainline publisher, the fact that the director didn't correct the name pronunciation, I mean, it's just one data point, but the data point says to me, rush to publish.
Yeah.
And so when you're in a rush, you know, you're not vetting what you should be vetting, I think.
I mean, it's like nobody checking work anymore. I mean, we see it in major publications all the time. Errors that used to only occur in like small town shitty newspapers with no staff. Now it's like on CNN and Fox News and MSNBC, everything. And there's just errors everywhere because people aren't crossing their T's or dotting their I's. It just strikes me as shocking that nobody is taking that time to do it. But when it's like, let's get it out, let's get our money, I don't know. I guess you'd think publishing a book would be a little bit more than just going live on a podcast.
It was just so evident of the lack of paying attention to the case. You know, there's thousands of, probably hundreds of thousands of people, if not even more, that have really paid a lot of close attention to this case. I remember I still had a hard time pronouncing their name, you know, the Gonzalez's, because it's a hard name to say. But when you listen enough, when you pay attention enough, you pick it up and you get it. And for the author who narrated his own book to, because again, the optic that was presented, again, just an opinion as we caveat, is that didn't even know the case well enough. First foray into true crime, and it was a deep dive or an attempt to do a deep dive on a case that was so extensively covered and so in the public eye that to make such a blatant error, and not only on his part, okay, but on the part of the director, the publisher, you're like, damn, that is just like one, it's not just a little data point. To me, yeah, it was like a huge chunk of what's going on here.
Yeah, it wasn't, you know, here's the raw studio session, let's get some outtakes. This is the album. This is the published work.
And didn't even do pickups. And so after you record a book, here's what goes on. You go to a studio, you narrate your book, and then what happens is when it goes to the publisher and it goes through editing, if they pick up on something that was missaid, misspoken, you do a thing called a pickup. You're either called back into a studio or you do it from your home, and you'll go through. I mean, it took me on Unbreakable Alliances, I think I did probably about another 45 minutes worth of pickups after I was directed to correct errors of speech, intonation, pronunciations. This wasn't even picked up after that. So that was kind of weird, man.
Yeah. It leaves a lot to be desired. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me, available wherever you get books. Go and check it out. And also be sure to press subscribe wherever you get podcasts. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, as always, thank you so much for joining us and giving us your valuable insight, as you always do every Thursday here on the program.
Thank you so much, Eric.
Your thoughts in the comment section. We will continue our conversation there. Until next time, for Eric, for Todd, for Robin, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed in the shadows.
I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic, very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you've taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, how to best kill somebody with a knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.